Hello, and welcome to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything
except your intelligence. I'm John Perry.
And I'm Ken Taylor. We're coming to you from the studios of 91.7 KALW, San Francisco's oldest and by far most innovative public radio station.
What amazes me about that, Ken, is that these little quiet conversations we start down at Philosopher's Corner on this subject or that subject can extend eventually all the way around the world, thanks to the magic of KALW Radio and the World Wide Web.
John, that sounds like a plug. That sounds like a plug for KALW's live audio stream at www.kalw.org.
It was a plug, Ken, but was it propaganda? That's the topic of today's show. Propaganda. What is it? How does it differ from other forms of information? And what, if anything, is wrong with it?
Well, you know, propaganda, I know that when I see it. It's all this false information that comes streaming at you through the media, through political discourse. It's everywhere, and it's really evil, I think.
Well, you know, Ken, just to be an old fud of a scholar about it, instead of taking a random walk through your memory banks, why don't we look at the OED definition of propaganda? It's interesting to see that the word comes from the Roman Catholic Church. In 1622, Pope Gregory founded the Congregatio de Propaganda Fide, the Congregation for Propagating the Faith. Presumably, in those days, there was no negative connotation to propaganda, but the current meaning is the systematic dissemination of doctrine, rumor, or selected information to propagate or promote a particular doctrine, view, practice. Frequently, this is the comment, it's frequently used in a derogatory way, and it sounds like it should be.
Yeah, you know, I mean, but to be a little bit resistant here, you know, it seems to me that some propaganda maybe is a good thing. So I wonder about that derogatory thing. So, you know, soldiers are about to go into battle, and the general's trying to steel their nerves, and he gives this rousing speech that tells them, go defeat the enemy and all that sort of stuff. He doesn't tell them, 40% of you are going to be killed, and another 20% are going to be wounded. We don't blame him for that, do we? So, I mean, is propaganda really necessarily bad?
Well, that's a good question. I think it's partly, as we say, a semantic issue, what we mean by it. Do we use the word propaganda more like sex or more like adultery? That is it just something that goes on all the time and in some cases is appropriate and in some cases it's inappropriate? Or is it something that's intrinsically bad? Maybe it's always bad, but it's much worse in some cases than others. A venial sin, to continue our Roman Catholic idea here, a venial sin if you're a used car salesman or a general, a mortal sin if you're one's own government lying
right,
and propagandizing your own people.
So you think maybe commercial entities, like car companies, car salesmen, all those sort of advertising companies don't necessarily have an obligation to tell us the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth, but maybe a political party or a government official does. So it's okay for governments to, it's bad for governments to propagandize, but not so bad for commercial entities to market, i.e. propagandize?
Well, maybe it's bad for commercial entities to propagandize, but there's kind of a law of the jungle there. The car salesmen that don't, a car salesman that gave you the whole truth and nothing but the truth probably wouldn't make enough commissions to survive. So you're going to end up with the car salesmen that are a bit more persuasive and maybe deceptive.
Yeah.
Maybe that's unfair to car salesmen.
But
there's something really wrong when the government lies to its own people.
Yeah, or misleads. I don't know if you have to lie to propagandize, but you just have to manipulate in a way. You can manipulate somebody into believing the truth. But what about, okay, we got the commercial entities like car companies and the government. What about journalists and the media? They're supposed to have some kind of privileged role in our society. Do you think it's all right for them to be organs of propaganda? It seems to me they're becoming more and more organs of propaganda.
Well, I agree with that assessment, and I think it's even worse for the journalists to propagandize than for the government. I mean, we've got the First Amendment there so that the journalists can uncover the truth and keep the government from lying to us and keep special interest groups from lying to us. So if the journalists end up lying to us and talking about spin zones and no spin zones when that's the exact opposite that's happening, that's really bad.
Yeah, and it's bad and it's depressing, and I sure wish we could do something about it. You know what? We have a person who can help us think really systematically about this because he's deeply involved in this issue, and that's our guest, Orville Schell, who's Dean of the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. He's author of lots of things, 14 books, including his most recent Virtual Tibet, an older book called Discos and Democracies. He's also written a preface to a book that's really pertinent to our discussion today, a book called Now They Tell Us. Dean Schell, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Pleasure to be here.
Hi, Dean Schell. Can I call you Orville?
You certainly may.
Okay, I'll do so then.
Can it's I do always... it too?
You both may.
Okay, yeah, it's always fun to call a dean by their first name. So we've been, Ken and I have had a little preliminary discussion here. And the question is, how should we think of propaganda? It's deceptive persuasion. But is it always wrong, or is it just wrong for some of the people some of the time? How do you think of it?
Well, I think by and large, propaganda, insofar as it distorts an issue, is wrong. I take your point about soldiers going into battle, or, you know, there are occasions when people need to have their loins girded for a struggle. But I think for a government to treat information as propaganda and to propagandize for one perspective rather than to help people think through an issue, that's entirely another question. You pointed out, I think rightfully so, that the word does come from the Catholic Church. And it began back in the 17th century when the Church was sending missionaries out around the world to proselytize for the true faith of Catholicism. And it wasn't until fascism really came in with Mussolini and Hitler that we got the notion of propaganda. Lenin and Stalin and Trotsky had a notion that, you know, a revolution needed to have a kind of a informational lift under its wings, and they had something called agitation and propaganda. And thus was born this idea of skewed information serving the purposes of a political movement or government.
Orville, let me challenge you just a little bit, just to see where this argument goes a little bit. You said you admitted the case that there might be cases like the general trying to rouse the battle for the troops for the battle. You know, he doesn't really have time to get into a long-term deliberation with them about whether we should charge this machine gun nest or not. But couldn't a wise political leader, I mean, Plato said, you know, political leaders are entitled for the common good to tell what he called the noble lie. Couldn't a wise and judicious political leader decide, look, here's the problem with the people. They are fickle, inattentive. You know, so if I engage, first of all, they won't engage in deliberation. Secondly, you know, they won't make the hard choices. So what I need to do is mobilize them. And sometimes to mobilize them to meet an enemy that they would, you know, let run over us, I need to propagandize them. So what's wrong with that? It's like the general trying to rouse the truth, the wise leader trying to rouse the body politic.
Well, that's exactly what Lenin did. He believed the masses had to be roused to beat back the landlords, the aristocrats, and the wealthy, the bourgeoisie. The question is, you know, when do you stop? And if you have a government that's built on the notion of propaganda, namely that the job of the press, of education, and of everything else that deals with information is to be the megaphone of the party, that's propaganda. Now, that doesn't create a kind of a diverse field of information.
Well, let me make a historical question here. I read somewhere, maybe something by Noam Chomsky, that actually the 20th century propaganda started in a big way with Woodrow Wilson and the attempts to get the American public sensitized to going into World War I on the side of the English. Is there any truth to that?
Well, I think every president, as they gird for war, does engage in a certain amount of somewhat prejudiced perspective, particularly if the threat is real. But very often threat isn't real, and still people are girded to go for war. I mean, I don't want to labor the point that propaganda is never good, but then it probably shouldn't be called propaganda. Propaganda has a very specific meaning, you know, to manipulate the public in the interests of a given government. Mm-hmm. And in my view, it is insidious.
Yeah, so, I agree with you, but let me ask you another question. We're talking about the government right now, and John, we mentioned in the opening the commercial enterprises, you know, the automobile manufacturer trying to sell his product. And we also talked about journalists becoming organs of propaganda. What do you think about, A, marketing as opposed to propaganda? Does it have the same insidious effect? And also talk to me about the role of journalism in distributing and manipulating public opinion, if you would.
Well, it's interesting. You know, the market, as it developed, did develop a very sophisticated technique of selling. And this came out of a man, Edward Bernays, who was the nephew of Sigmund Freud and understood well how psychology works and how you make people want things or not want things and what's the very complex mechanisms by which their minds work. And he developed public relations, and this was his contribution. It was interesting because the Nazis borrowed this, and they were sort of the first really, really aggressive, full-blown example of propaganda with all the bells and whistles, the flags, the uniforms, the iconography, the, you know, the whole yeah. panoply of ritual. And then this began to morph into, you know, the consumer society. But it was borrowed by politics with greater and greater quotients. It really started in this country with Richard Nixon, who was the first one, at least to my knowledge, who hired public relations people to work on his staff and to learn how to spin, to learn how to sell, in effect, him, just as if you were a product.
So, Orville, so let me ask, but my question, do you think, as John seemed to think, I'm not sure if he really thinks this, that in the commercial sphere, in the economy, the marketing and advertising, which has a lot of the feel of propaganda, right, is okay, is morally okay? Is that okay? And political discourse of this kind is not okay? I wonder what your views are.
In other words, I mean, if you're selling a car and you have a beautiful woman who's totally irrelevant to the merits of the car, sit on it to sell it, and you don't mention that your competitor gets lower gas mileage, that's not maybe ideal behavior, but it's pretty understandable. But if George Bush has a beautiful woman sit on his policy and try to sell it, that seems to me objectionable in a different way.
Well, I think, you know, the consequences are greater to the latter than the former, and we're so accustomed to it in the marketplace that everybody does good PR for their product. But we are not so accustomed in the political realm, nor should we, I think, become so, because actually these issues are of enormous importance, and we really do need to know a variety of views to come to any logical conclusions about what we think and how we want to vote.
Yeah, I think I disagree with the two. I'm not sure, not if you took a firm stance, but I actually think in the marketplace, this is nearly as bad and nearly as destructive. I mean, we Americans drive around in gas-guzzling cars, right, despite the severe damage it does to the environment and ultimately to our collective life on this planet. Why? Well, because we have this manipulated demand for these things. What manipulates this demand? The desire of Detroit and to have high profit margins, because these gas-guzzling cars, you know, there's a high margin on those things. So this creation of demand, I think, is a destructive force too. So I wouldn't let these guys morally off the hook.
Well, it's one thing to not let them morally off the hook, but still, when you've got your own elected officials who are, after all, using your money to support their propaganda, lying to you, it really undermines the whole idea of democracy. And so it seems to me, you know, there's a special place in hell for them. Maybe the car salesman can be up in the less vile regions of hell, but these guys are going to be down with the popes that are having hot tar poured on their heels.
Yeah.
Well, I don't think you can actually segregate these two worlds quite as discreetly as you might like. The truth is, we are a commercial culture. We are sated. We are steeped in advertising and public relations, and we hardly know what's real and not real anymore. And now, with a vengeance, it has entered our political system, and our political system has turned into propaganda. The very sort of phenomena that we just call commercial in the commercial realm. So I think it's pretty dangerous. I don't like to be lied to, whether it's about a gas guzzler or a president.
Now, but isn't it fair to say, I mean, just that it's not just the government, but also the other side? I mean, take Fahrenheit 9/11, a movie I must say I thoroughly enjoyed. But it's hard to deny that all or at least many of the devices of propaganda are used in that, fast-cutting, incomplete, so forth and so on. Is that any better or worse?
Well, I don't think that the opposition to our current government or any government is any purer than any of the rest of it. I mean, I think the point is we are all infected by this sort of notion of spin, which grew directly out of propaganda. And when propaganda began to merge with selling techniques and the consumerist society.
Orville, we're going to take that up a little bit more in a little bit. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. We've been defining propaganda, talking about what exactly is so bad about it with our guest, Orville Schell, Dean of the UC Berkeley School of Journalism.
Some people associate propaganda only with totalitarian political regimes, Nazi Germany, Iraq under Saddam Hussein, or communist China. But there's plenty of skilled propagandists right here in the good old U.S. of A, too. In our next segment, we'll exploit the expertise of Orville Schell to compare and contrast democratic and totalitarian uses of propaganda.
And here to tell us how you can join us at Philosopher's Corner is General Manager Nicole Sawaya, along with our roving philosophical reporter, Amy Standen.
Thanks, Ken. And it's true, I am a producer on this show, but I spend most of my time on the other end of the radio, which is why it's such a thrill to be here. I am addicted. I have a confession to make. I am totally addicted to public radio. And this is true for a lot of people I know. We sit home. We are constantly listening to KALW. And guess what? We are here. Nicole and I are here to tell you that this stuff does not come for free.
Exactly right, Amy. And the number for you to call is 800-525-9917. Good afternoon. I'm Nicole, joining Amy, the roving reporter, the philosophical roving reporter.
That's right.
We're only taking a few minutes here, but it's very important that you call 800-525-9917. This is the last day of our spring membership drive, Amy. We are so close to getting to our goal, our overall financial goal. We're less than $14,000 away mm-hmm. from making our overall financial goal. And we don't want to have to come back in a month or 2 months. We know we can make this goal. We need your help. We need each of you mm-hmm. to call 800-525-9917.
That's 800-525-9917. And to help you pick up the phone, we've got some great gifts today. First of all, we have this terrific book, Now They Tell Us, The American Press in Iraq. And that has an introduction, a preface to it that's written by our guest on Philosophy Talk today, Orville Schell. We also have, this is really exciting, a Philosopher's Corner brunch. We did this last year. It was a huge hit. So we're going to do it again.
That's right, Amy. We have a brunch at the Philosopher's Corner at the prestigious Stanford University, mm-hmm. south of us here and in Palo Alto. If you want to come solo and you can pledge $125, you will be part of the Philosopher's Corner on Sunday, June 5th. I believe that's a Sunday, at the brunch at the Philosopher's Corner. So you get brunch, you get to meet the philosophers, and I believe that John Perry shows you all the buried bodies at
Stanford.
He does.
John Perry gives his own humorous tour of the Stanford campus, which of course spends most of its time on Philosopher's Corner. Or for $50, you can go home with Now They Tell Us, The American Press and Iraq. Again, the number is 1-800-525-9917. And Nicole, if you'll let me, I want to clear up a common misconception.
Please
about
do, Amy.
Public radio pledge drives. I think a lot of people think that when they give money to a station, they are giving money to public radio in general, to NPR, to PRI, to one of these big, you know, huge mega stations that has, you know, a fair amount of money. This is not the case, and I can tell you, sitting here at KALW, this is a community station that squeezes every penny it gets and that really needs this cash. So I just want to invite all the listeners, not just for Philosophy Talk, but everyone out there to call 1-800-525-9917 and give money to this terrific station.
Well, Amy, as I often say, not all public radio stations are created equal. when we go on Pledge Drive, it's to bring support, financial support, only to 91.7 KALW. So thank you for helping to clear up that misperception.
Well, sure.
And I'm sure that there's some philosophy behind all that and where those perceptions come from. But we're not going
to
dwell
we'll
on that right
the
now.
Philosophers.
We have open phone lines, ladies and gentlemen. That means you are not calling 800-525-9917. If you can pledge at the $200 level, two of you can go to brunch at the Philosopher's Corner on June 5th at Stanford University with our philosophers, with the whole crew, actually, mm-hmm. from Philosophy Talk.
I'll be there. Ian Scholes will be there.
Cool.
It's a whole morning of philosophy, and it is a really good time. I can tell you that for sure. I was there last year. It's a really nice event. Or for $50, you can have the book, Now They Tell Us, The American Press in Iraq, which has a preface, which is written by Orville Schell, who is the dean of the Graduate School of Journalism at UC Berkeley. He's also our guest today. And these are two terrific gifts. I really invite everyone to call 1-800-525-9917. We need your help.
We do need your help because this is the last day of the fund drive. We really want to get to our overall goal. We know we can do it, but every phone has to get busy right now. Pledge at whatever level that you can. If you can pledge at a thank you gift level, you will not be disappointed with the Philosopher's Corner. 800-525-9917, 800-KALW-917. Or you can pledge online. There's many, many listeners that listen all over the world to Philosophy Talk. We know this. You can pledge online as well. Just go to KALW.org.
And it's really important that you call right now. If Philosophy Talk is a show that you love, we want to hear from all of the armchair philosophers out there. We want to hear from the people who, you know, they may not be studying philosophy in school, but they really love to think critically about things. 1-800-525-9917.
Back to the philosophers.
That's the Bee Gees and Jive Talking. I'm John Perry, and you know, Kenneth, it's so great to listen to the Bee Gees again. How wonderful that we chose a topic that allowed our producers to come up with the Bee Gees. I mean, I wonder if we put our minds to it, maybe we could get a topic and we could listen to Pat Boone or ABBA or any of those ones we might never have to listen to again.
John, okay. I'm Ken Taylor. This is a Philosophy Talk, and we're discussing propaganda. Do you know propaganda when you hear it or see it? Is it really such a bad thing or just a morally neutral tool for public persuasion? Tell us what you think. Do so by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. Or send us an email at comments@philosophytalk.org.
Now, we've been discussing propaganda, which we've defined more or less as the attempt to persuade using half-truths and deception. We've kind of been slightly disagreeing about whether propaganda is always wrong, or whether in advertising situations and market situations it might be morally permissible, but we seem to agree that for governments to use it is particularly bad.
Our guest today is Orville Schell, dean of the UC Berkeley School of Journalism. He's author of Virtual Tibet, and he's written a preface to that book that Amy Standen mentioned, Now They Tell Us. Orville, I've got a question for you. We kind of touched on this a little bit. We talked about Stalin and Mao and Hitler being the experts of, you know, experts in propaganda. And some people think, when they hear propaganda, they think totalitarian governments, right? But you know, there are lots of very skilled propagandists in democracy as well. And I wonder if you can tell me how propaganda works differently in a democracy versus a totalitarian society, if you can comment on that a bit.
Well, you know, when I first went to China, while Mao Zedong was still alive, this was truly a complete propaganda state. I mean, all the billboards, all the radio, there wasn't television then. I mean, every form of public information was occupied by the party. And you could really see the effect. I mean, people were fearful. They couldn't think. They couldn't talk. They dared not have friends. There was no dissenting views. I think where the difference between propaganda and this sort of other commercial variant we're talking about is most obvious, is that in a democracy, we do have many kinds of propaganda. But there are islands of antidotes that challenge it. Sometimes they're not very effective, and sometimes they are. But at least there isn't a kind of a uniform wall of similar and distorted, twisted information coming out of the government. There is a possibility to challenge it. Now, some people may say, well, if you don't have the media on your side, or you don't have very much of it on your side, how can you really challenge it? Well, still, it is possible to think devious thoughts, to speak, to write, to assemble in all these myriad ways. And this is, I think, how it differs from a totalitarian state.
But Orville, see, it makes me think that what you said about the fear, right, in a totalitarian state is partly, it's not just, that's not just the effect of the propaganda, that's the effect of the willingness of the state to bludgeon you into submission. And it seems to me that the arts, the propagandistic arts in a totalitarian state, even though they're sometimes practiced to a high level, in a democracy, we have to practice those arts really exquisitely. So the
propaganda is more subtle and insidious because the state doesn't bludgeon you into believing. It's just got to con you into believing, and it's got to be a much better con man.
Yeah, but I guess the good news is we've got people that are really good at insidious and subtle developments of propaganda.
I mean, what do you think about that thought?
Well, I think that's precisely where this marriage between public relations and politics is most alarming, because what we have is not the situation I ran into in China or that Lenin confronted in Russia in the 20s. The Third Reich, what we have is this most extraordinarily and exquisitely complicated and well-thought-out system of advertising, spinning, that's based on market samples and surveys and, you know, how do you get people to do this, that, and the other. So in other words, in a democracy, we are up against, as you pointed out, some really sophisticated advertising techniques that make the old propaganda states of totalitarian regimes look positively clunky by comparison.
Right, exactly. You're listening to Philosophy Talk. You can join our discussion by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. And Bill in Chicago took the opportunity to do that. Bill, welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi.
So what's your comment or question, Bill?
Well, my comment is that when everybody uses the term democracy, when basically the voting has become a sham and we have, you know, people that are religious fundamentalists that complain about other fundamentalists running the country in a criminal manner, that you're using the word democracy as if it's different than a totalitarian state.
So, Bill, when you say voting has become a sham, do you mean you don't think our votes are actually counted accurately, or that public opinion is so manipulated that voting doesn't mean anything?
Well, voting would mean something if it was honestly counted, but since it isn't and it's manipulated by obvious people on one side of the situation, that you no longer have a democracy. And I know some people, friends of mine that are 82nd Airborne and things like that, says, well, we all know democracy doesn't work. So they're already starting to get people thinking that democracy is like a failed state.
Yeah, thanks, Bill. Orville, you got a response to that?
Well, I think, you know, the dilemma as it manifests itself in our country is not purely one of voting. I believe our votes more or less are counted accurately, and we certainly do have a chance to express ourselves. What I worry about is that the state of public information is so corrupted through whatever you want to call it propaganda, that people are really deceived easily by what's in their interest, what's in the interest of the nation, what's in the interest of the world. And that, to me, is a far greater problem than, you know, the elections themselves.
We've got an email, interesting email from Pete in San Francisco. I'm not going to read all of it, but a very interesting point he makes is that Walter Lippmann, one of the icons of American journalism, once said that democracy requires manufacture of consent. And you certainly see that in the show that's been on TV lately about Franklin Delano Roosevelt and the manufacture of the willingness to go to war. But Lippmann was a great defender of democracy and journalism. I mean, what is this idea of manufacture of consent? Has it done more harm or good?
Well, I do think, you know, that it's legitimate within a democracy to try to attain a certain majority consent by discussion, argument, debate, and public information. And it may be that, you know, that's what leadership is about, to honestly convince people that the course the leader wishes to follow is the prudent one, the right one. And I think that's the process that consent should be manufactured under. I don't think we want to see manufactured consent by a government that arrogates all of the media outlets at its disposal to a relentless sort of one-note, one-party diatribe in the favor of one thing or another. I think that does not serve a democracy well.
I think you're right, Orville. But we've been focusing on the government and politicians, and we've kind of let the media itself off the hook, because it seems to me that the media has, by becoming highly corporatized, has become an instrument of the manufacturer of consent, rather than an instrument of, you know, full, fulsome information and engaging us, freely in public deliberation. I think the media has become part of the problem.
Let me put a little addendum on that remark of Ken's in the way of a question to Orville. Two recent developments, cable TV and the Internet. How are they impacting propaganda, freedom of the press, and our ability to get good information instead of propaganda?
Well, on the one hand, you'd think that the increased number of media outlets would help be helpful. But the truth is that the bandwidth of opinion is almost as narrow as it was before. And moreover, the kind of programs they have are so skewed and so lacking in intelligent discussion usually that it's very difficult for people, I think, to come to rational conclusions about what's going to affect them.
You're talking about cable TV there.
Well, certainly cable TV. I wouldn't say the networks are doing that good a job. They have a half an hour of news on. Now it looks like Nightline, the one truly, you know, informative program on network television, looks like that's going to end. So you'd have to say by absence, they are defaulting.
But why is that? Why we have this First Amendment? We have this amazingly large media structures. Why is it? How has this happened that they've become, if I'm right, they've become instruments, propaganda instruments, rather than instruments of informing a free populace about the options? I mean, how's that happened?
Let me give you a little example. Cheney denied saying something, and there was film that he said it. I forget exactly what it was. The only news outlet that showed it was The Daily Show with Jon Stewart on the Comedy Channel. How did we ever end up at where people like me mainly rely on Jon Stewart for news?
Yes, I saw that very program. I don't know, and I think it's very, very alarming. I think that the press should be skeptical. It should be perform its watchdog role as a skeptical fourth estate. In my experience, that's what most reporters would like to do. Not all of them, but a lot of them are trained very well. The question is, where are they going to do it? Who's going to provide the resources for them to do long investigative stories around the world? Who is going to give them the space? And then you get to the point, to the question of once they do it, who's paying attention? Mass media rules, and the New York Times has a circulation of about 1.2 million. It's minuscule compared to television and radio.
Yeah.
So if, in effect, you don't get on television and in radio, you, in effect, are out of the game.
Philip in Brisbane, you want to say something good about propaganda, I think. Isn't that right? Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Philip.
Oh, thanks. Well, since you were you mentioned good propaganda, I just wanted to say that if you go to any public library and you get any book on philosophy, especially modern philosophers aimed at the general reader, Thomas Paine is always included in the list, but he's generally dissed as a philosopher or not included as a real philosopher on the grounds that he doesn't have the intellectual chops to qualify. But he's always highly praised as a successful propagandist, and especially if the author is praising his efforts towards the revolution. And I was just wondering what your take on Paine is as a philosopher and a propagandist.
Well, he's one of my favorite philosophers, but not because he made cutting-edge distinctions, but because he got out there in the public arena and made a difference. He had a rather interesting life. I don't remember the details. Didn't end up all that too well. Now, was what he was doing propaganda? It was definitely persuasion, and it wasn't what we'd call objective and balanced. But to what extent, Philip, do you think he actually distorted the truth or engaged in telling half-truths, the kind of things that I think of as definitional of propaganda?
Well, I think you could find the best example of that in his book, The Age of Reason. That's where he just didn't hold back at all.
Yeah, that's more anti-religion than the common sense was sort of a more political, if I got that right?
Yeah, much more persuasive, an effort towards persuasion through reason, I thought.
I think we're going to have to break now for some efforts at persuasion.
Well, yeah. I mean, you raise a big question. I think distinguishing persuasion from propaganda is an important thing. When you try to be persuasive, you try to be persuasive. But we're discussing propaganda with Orville Schell, dean of the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. Unlike the sources of propaganda, which we've been talking about, KALW shoots straight, which is why we need your help to keep programs like Philosophy Talk on the air.
Here now to let you know how you can help are KALW's general manager, Nicole Sawaya, and, my goodness, our own roving philosophical reporter, the one, the only, Amy Standen.
John, that was quite an introduction.
Take it away, Amy. Drum roll.
I think Orville Schell gave us the perfect segue to this pledge drive, Nicole. What do you think? I mean, the truth is we can't count on the major media outlets to give us the news we need. So here we are, folks. You know, this is your public radio station, your non-corporate, your independent news and information source, asking you for support at a time when we desperately need it. The phone number is 1-800-525-9917.
800-525-9917. And Amy, KALW is not content with just one news provider either. Nope. Not only do we bring you national public radio news, but we also provide you with the BBC, the CBC from our neighbors up north, and we're growing our own local news department incrementally. That's how it's done, step by step. We raise our money caller by caller. And right now we need to get all those phones busy, Amy, because I have challenged the philosophers to raise $5,000 for this hour, 800-525-9917. And we just got a challenge phoned in from Janet Stemwhistle. She gave us a $200 dollar-for-dollar match in support of John Dupre, who was last week's guest on Philosophy Talk. So right now, ladies and gentlemen, every call called in will be matched up to $200, 800-525-9917. We have some terrific thank you gifts as well.
That's right. We have, first of all, a book called Now They Tell Us, The American Press in Iraq, and that has a preface in it written by today's guest, Orville Schell. But first, before I tell you about the other gift, I want to tell you who I want to hear from, Nicole. I want to hear from our callers. Every week we get callers to Philosophy Talk. Today we've had Bill, we've had Harry. I want to hear from you guys. We get called. How many shows do you know get calls like, tell me, what did Kierkegaard have to say about free will? I mean, I'm not kidding. We get these calls every week, and I want to hear from all of you Philosophy Talk callers right now at 1-800-525-9917. Once again, we have a terrific gift, bunch of gifts we're giving away, actually. One of them is a book with a preface written by Orville Schell, and we've also got a great brunch.
And the book also, by the way, was written by Michael Massing. He writes a lot for the New York Review of Books. He is a MacArthur Fellow, and he's the contributing editor of the Columbia Journalism Review. It's actually quite a current book. I was just thumbing through it, and a great intro by Orville Schell. Yours if you can pledge at the $50 level. Otherwise, we have, talk about lots of birds, one stone. We have the brunch at the Philosopher's Corner on June 5th. You can come solo if you can pledge $125, or you can bring a pal if you pledge at the $200 level. What you get is brunch. You get a lot of rousing debate and discussion with the philosophers. You get the tour done by our inimitable John Perry, who's going to show you all the crooks and crannies of Stanford University, and you get a beautiful, beautiful day down south at Palo Alto.
Palo Alto campus.
Give us a call, 800-525-9917. I see that there are four phone lines open. We need to fill every one, Amy, because this is the last day of our membership drive.
This is it.
We really want to get to goal. We have less than $14,000 to raise to get to that financial goal. And we'll stop this drive as soon as we make that financial goal.
And we can do it. I know we can. I know, because I'm here every week. I see the phones ringing. I hear feedback from listeners, the people like me who are seriously dealing with an addiction to public radio. I know you are out there, and we need to hear from you. This stuff does not come for free. 800-525-9917. I know we can raise this money, and I really want to hear from all of you listeners out there, especially you Philosophy Talk diehard fans. 1-800-525-9917.
800-525-9917. And if you're listening online, give us a call at that number as well. Continue to listen online, but give us a call. That online listening comes with a cost. Unfortunately, it just doesn't come for free. It does come with a cost. Help us to defray all the expenses here at KALW. Again, as Amy succinctly pointed out, no public radio stations are not created equally. When you give, you are giving to KALW and KALW only. 800-525-9917. Bring a mate. Go to the brunch. Mm-hmm. $200 gets you in. And right now, every pledge coming in is matched up to $200.
And what a bargain you're getting. I mean, we're talking $125 or $200 for a couple for a year's worth of listening to terrific programming. It's true you can hear Fresh Air four times a day in San Francisco, and I love Fresh Air, but KALW is a station that is devoted to the best of both worlds. You hear all the NPR and PRI shows you love, but you also get fresh, original programming. And that is KALW's gift for you for the bargain price of a gift. Once, you know, call in now.
It's up to you. It's an act of philanthropy. 800-525-9917. Gentlemen, back to you.
I'm John Perry. That was not ABBA. That was not the Bee Gees. That was not Pat Boone. That was Public Enemy with Don't Believe the Hype. And the person you heard breakdancing in the next room was Nicole Sawaya. You're listening to Philosophy Talk, the program that questions everything.
Except your intelligence. I'm Ken Taylor. So, John, you like that's a little more contemporary for you?
That's my kind of music,
yeah,
you know.
Right. I can see you just breakdancing to that or something. Our subject today, propaganda. You can join our discussion. We're eager to hear from you by calling 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134.
We've been talking about what propaganda is, the deceptive use of half-truths and symbols and all sorts of devices to persuade by manipulation rather than reason. We've been discussing whether it's worse for it to be used by governments and politicians than by advertisers and marketers. We've been discussing about how it's prevalent in democracies as well as totalitarians. States, although it has to be a little more subtle and clever.
So join our discussion. Give us a call, 415-841-4134. 415-841-4134. Last but not least, send us an email to comments@philosophytalk.org. Our guest today is Orville Schell, Dean of the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism. So, Orville, here's a question for you. Look, we talked about the insidious nature of propaganda in democracies and how propagandistic arts are developed to a really high art form. And look, you've got to admit, the stuff is really effective. Question, why does it work so well on us? And can we do anything? Can we do anything to sort of, you know, immunize ourselves against the effects of propaganda? What do you think?
Well, I know if you, for instance, looked at the Democratic and the Republican conventions this time, I think you would see the modern-day version of the Nuremberg rallies in Germany. This is not to say that the president and John Kerry are Nazis, only that this use of sort of heraldic iconography, the huge stages, the flags waving everywhere, the sets, the massive, expensive sets which are built for these occasions, are all part of, you know, as you say, this very, very sophisticated, slick kind of presentation that I think we would have to call propaganda. What can you do about it? Well, I think public radio is one thing you can do about it, and public radio is there. Doesn't have as many listeners as it ought to, but this, it seems to me, though, for a democracy to have a truly effective antidote, it needs more than occasional little atoll in a sort of archipelago of challengers of this very powerful commercial political world that we see enveloping the whole country.
I agree with you. Harry in Berkeley's on the line. Why don't you give us your comment or question? Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Well, I wanted to suggest that propaganda is really can be thought of as an evolutionary strategy. You know, we're all born propagandists for something or other. We have, you know, colorful feathers or, you know, we're able to puff up ourselves to look more alluring or bigger to our, you know, potential mates. So, you know, it's built into us. And I think that, you know, we can't just say that it's something that, you know, that tendency and that need to do that can be completely gotten rid of. So I don't think it's black and white. I don't think it's a matter of, you know, it's all right or it's all wrong. I don't think it's a matter of saying that the commercial realm can do it, but the state can't. I think it's a matter of degree. We have to moderate it. And I think that the distinction to be made is really around the question of deception. We have to ask ourselves, you know, the moral question, I think, how deceptive is it?
Well, I think that's a good point. I mean, when a parent tells a kid, stop at the crosswalk, he's not giving him reasons. He's just producing an effect, maybe with a little bit of intimidation. And that's pretty much okay. But then when we get to the sophisticated, what's supposed to be sophisticated adult interaction and reason giving, and we have deception or failure to give reasons or explanations, that's a whole different thing, even though it, as you say, it kicks into very natural parts of human life.
Gabriel in San Francisco. Welcome to Philosophy Talk, Gabriel.
Hello?
Yeah. What's your comment or question?
My comment is that we should give some credit to the intelligence of the people because, you know, you cannot manipulate the people to a certain point. Because look at the example of Mr. Berlusconi. He owns three TV, private TV, and he's prime minister, so he controls the state TV, newspaper, magazine, and he was badly defeated last, you know, week, 2 weeks ago in the Italian election.
Yeah.
So, I mean,
Gabriel, thanks for the comment, Gabriel. I'm not sure I'd take too much comfort in that. First of all, Italy and the United States are really different because there are all those competing parties in Italy. I think in America, part of the problem is the range of acceptable opinion is so narrow. Orville, what do you think about that? The range of stuff that actually gets publicly debated is so narrow.
Well, I think that's partially a problem that's produced by the media and their unwillingness to do anything that seems to step outside of the rather narrow band of discussion that they feel comfortable with. And I think unless there is a greater willingness to come a little more broad in one's views and the dimensions of discussion, it's very hard to puncture these sort of official propaganda myths that get set up. I mean, this is the point of a press conference. Now, certain presidents, I mean, all presidents want to propagandize for their policies. It's not just that this president now is unique in that respect. But press conferences are usually sort of two-way interactions where you actually get answers. I've just been reading some transcripts of press conferences with Scott McClellan where people would ask the same question again and again and again, and they would get the same ridiculous, unsatisfactory answer.
So you might, Orville, you might think that they should have stopped asking the same question again and again and again and tried something else. But we have one last caller.
Well, you might, but if I could just interject, the question needs to be asked and needs to be answered.
Well, that's
true. We have a system that doesn't demand that it be answered.
I think those guys figure their voters are not listening to the press conference, so what the heck.
Gerard in Oakland, we have time for one last brief comment. Welcome to Philosophy Talk.
Hi. Well, I think it's important to understand that there's backdoor propaganda as well as front door, straight out propaganda. An example of this would be, well, if we call state-sanctioned racism, there's no question about what it is, and everybody can smell it up front. But when we call state-sanctioned racism affirmative action, well, then it gets all touchy-feely and fuzzy smelling.
Well, that's true. That's true. Gerard, you're making a good point. A lot of the issue is in how we frame things, and some framing takes it one way and some thinks it
another. Like the so-called Clear Skies Act.
Yeah, yeah.
Save Our Forests.
On that note, Orville, I'm going to unfortunately have to say goodbye to you. This has been a great conversation. I wish we had more time, but, you know, we got to do a little business here. Our guest has been Orville Schell, Dean of the UC Berkeley Graduate School of Journalism, author of Virtual Tibet. Thanks for joining us, Orville.
Glad to be with you.
Thanks a lot, Orville.
You're welcome.
So what did we learn today, John?
Well, I think what I learned is that propaganda is rather a rich and interesting field for philosophers to think about. Philosophers are most happy thinking about something like the nature of time or how do we know about the past, things that may not have too much practical value because everybody pretty much is happy
with
the past.
I love thinking about these stuff with
practical. But propaganda, I mean, there's all kinds of interesting questions that we came up with. To what extent is it inevitable? What's the right definition of it? We like to say the truth, the whole truth, nothing but the truth. We really couldn't stand people that gave us nothing but the truth. They'd be dreadful bores. There's a lot of room to think here, Ken.
Yeah, there certainly is. You know, I think it's a really complicated thing. I wish we could have talked more about how we could avoid the effects of propaganda. I wrote a blog entry at the blog.philosophytalk.org that talks a little bit about winning the battle one mind at a time. But we'll
We'll talk about that. You read my blog entry and add some comments. And joining us now to give us the truth, the whole truth, and nothing but the truth about propaganda, the 60-second philosopher.
Ian Scholz. Philosopher Bertrand Russell called propaganda the foul literature of glory. In the recent book, The Age of Propaganda, the authors define it as the communication of a point of view with the ultimate goal of having the recipient of the appeal come to voluntarily accept this position as if it were his or her own. Going back to the ancient Greeks, the sophists maintained that the truth about an issue could only be discovered by arguing for both sides. Plato held that arguing both sides clouded the understanding of truth. Aristotle attempted a reconciliation of these two views. In the Rhetoric, he held that knowledge could only be gained via logic and reasoning. Since not all people are able to reason clearly, then persuasion is necessary to communicate the truth to them. Propaganda as a term first appeared in the 17th century, when Pope Gregory XV formed the Sacred Congregation for Propagating the Faith. Propaganda was seen as a good thing. Propaganda started to lose its luster with the suffragette movement, which used flyers, posters, and novels contrasting educated women with criminals and the insane because, like them, women could not vote. Their propaganda efforts supposedly created public resistance to the women's movement. Drumming up support for U.S. entry into World War I, President Woodrow Wilson created the Committee of Public Information, not, you will note, the Committee of Public Propaganda, headed by muckraker George Creel. The Creel Committee churned out movies, posters, flyers, news releases, songs, slideshows, and books, all designed to whip up war fever and make Germans look like barbaric monkeys. Sauerkraut was renamed Liberty Cabbage, shades of American fries. After the war, Creel wrote, "In all things, from first to last, without halt or change, it was a plain publicity proposition, a vast enterprise in salesmanship, the world's greatest adventure in advertising." But Adolf Hitler wrote in Mein Kampf that the war propaganda of the English and Americans was psychologically correct. After 4.5 years, revolution broke out in Germany, slogans for which came from the enemy's propaganda. Hitler used our own propaganda to help in his rise to power. Yes, propaganda has a way of coming back to bite you. Weapons of mass destruction, anybody? I gotta go.